Welcome back into the Informed Patient Radio Show. Today's guest, Bob Lee, consultant for security and emergency management. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
We always like to start the program with our guest and getting a little bit of background, where they're from and kind of what led them up to what they're doing today. So if you can just give us a little bit of background on yourself.
I grew up in Burbank, California. One of three boys, and I got interested in the field of emergency management back when there was a Tehachapi earthquake back in the 50s. I was at my uncle's ranch up in Kernville, and it just intrigued me how the ground moved and what was that. And then the way he explained it to me, I said, well, that's really interesting. So that was really where the seed was planted.
Oh, that was the seed, yeah.
As I went through school and graduated from high school, I decided that I really wanted to be the next world's greatest chef. So I went to culinary school, or I enrolled in culinary school.
Oh.
At the same time, my father said, well, are you going to join the military? And I said, I guess so, because my brother had done it, and he had done it. So we went over to the Naval Reserve Station in North Hollywood and signed me up. It was back in the 60s, early 60s.
Oh, wow.
So while I was going to culinary school, I was going to reserve meetings, and my aptitude test steered me towards logistics and acquisitions.
Wow.
Storekeeper.
Yeah.
Was the rate.
Oh, okay.
So I found that interesting, and I also figured out that people need stuff in a disaster, and that a storekeeper in the Navy and supplies, well, it was like one puzzle. All of a sudden, you got the last piece of the puzzle and said, well, that's pretty interesting.
So, oh, yeah.
After I got out of culinary school, I got a job right away, and I basically was told that I'd be slicing and dicing for the next 5 years. And I said, well, that's no good.
Yeah.
So, wow.
So after getting my culinary degree, I decided that's not good enough. So I took some more correspondence courses with the Navy. I took a lot of them, actually. And the more courses I took, the more interested I got. And then my cousin was a sheriff sergeant at L.A. County Sheriff's Department.
Oh, okay.
He said, hey, we're looking for good people, so why don't you join? So I told him I was in the Navy Reserve and that I had to go on active duty because I had completed college and either continue college or go on active duty. So I said, I have to do the active duty because I don't have enough money to continue college. So he said, well, go ahead. The Navy will probably be able to help you, which they did. So I went on active duty, spent the first 2 weeks in a beautiful place called Sasebo, Japan. And I thought I had died and gone to heaven. Then we were told to pack up. We're going to a place called Da Nang.
Oh.
And this is 1964. I didn't even know what a Da Nang was, but I found out real quick. So I spent 2 years in Da Nang, Vietnam, building up the Navy supply base there. I got off active duty, and I came home, and I joined the Sheriff's Department. And on the Sheriff's Department, I did the usual patrol and detectives and all those things. And we had the 1971 earthquake.
So and I remember that one.
And I was sent with several other deputies up to the VA hospital, and we were helping dig people out and do all those things. And it rekindled that fire about disaster preparedness and emergency. And that was it. I just I started leaning that way on the Sheriff's Department and worked my way into doing a lot of logistical things. And Sheriff's Department was a great learning ground. And after I retired, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to go into the business. But I got a job at Great Western Financial Corporation, which included security and emergency management. So I was responsible for the two things that I really liked. You know, and I spent a number of years at Great Western before they were purchased by Washington Mutual. And then after that, I decided, well, I think it's time to go out on my own and see what I can do. And consequently, a friend of mine who was assistant chief of the LA Fire Department, who started the CERT program, Community Emergency Response Team program, back in 1986, I believe. He retired, and we were sitting at Caro's in San Pedro, and we decided that we would open up a consulting company called Borden Lee Consulting. And the last 20 years, that's what we've been doing.
Oh, so what was the initial, like when you guys decided to do the consulting, was there a lot of need for it? Or did you have to kind of work it a little bit and convince corporations that they need this? What was the general response at the time?
Well, I had been with Great Western for a number of years, and we had been involved in many disasters across the country. Great Western had offices in 32 states, and the first big one was Hurricane Andrew back in 1992.
Right.
So that was a very educational endeavor to learn all about hurricanes and how it decimates the entire southern Florida area and things that need to be done. So that was really good. And then we worked on some projects that dealt with wildland fires and mass evacuations. And then, of course, the 1994 Northridge earthquake. And all of those things just pointed us right to where we could start a consulting company because we had a pretty good record of being involved with those disasters and,
right.
and learning about what needs to be done and what's not important. And that's how we started our consulting company.
So, Bob, what would be some of the things that you felt needed to be done at that time, and what ways were you able to help with that?
Well, we determined that the public in general was not as well informed as they could be. We determined that many companies, corporations, both large and small, and cities for that matter, did not have a good understanding of what their role was in a disaster. And trying to deal with it at the time of the disaster was not necessarily prudent. So we thought that we could find that niche about getting people geared up so that when something did happen, they were ready to prepare for it, or they were prepared for it, and they were ready to handle it, and they knew what they needed to do. Comes back to a question that I had that has gone with me for a long time. It's like, well, what happened? If you don't know what happened, how are you going to do anything about it?
Right.
And if you do know what happened, so you need to say to yourself, okay, what can I or we do about it? And the next part of that would be, what do we have? What resources do we have to deal with this? If you don't know those things, there's no way to get started.
True.
You're in the middle of something and you don't know what you're doing. So we've decided that would be our premise, is that what happened? What are we going to do about it? And what resources do we have? We went in, we talked to many companies and cities and school districts, and they said, well, that makes sense. So we got hired. And at one point, we were pedaling so fast, we didn't have any time to do anything with our family. So,
oh, wow.
It's been great 20 years, of doing this. We've learned a lot. We've gained a lot of experience dealing with big and small things. Disasters are those situations that overwhelm the agency or the company's ability to deal with them.
Right.
Otherwise, it's just an emergency that you can deal with.
Oh, yeah.
But disasters, right. The resources are used up. You have to find extreme amounts of resources outside your normal day-to-day environment.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Knowing where to do that and how to do that and getting ready to do that is really important.
And you help the corporation set up like a disaster plan?
Absolutely. We would actually go in and write disaster plans. We did one for one of the biggest retirement systems in the United States. We've done it for school districts, for all types of corporations, and for private citizens. Yeah.
Right.
We were very involved in the Community Emergency Response Team program, which my partner started back in 86, and it's all over the world now.
That's a nice little topic, the CERT training and the CERT teams. How would a normal or how a regular citizen get involved with CERT? What would be the steps and what's involved?
Well, in Los Angeles, for example, the city of Los Angeles has a disaster preparedness division, and they put on regular CERT training programs.
Right.
Many other cities also do it through the fire departments, sometimes through other types of organizations. But basically, it's 22 to 24 hours of basic understanding of disasters, learning how to use fire extinguishers and hoses. The fire department just can't be everywhere all the time. They teach people how to be more self-sufficient at a slightly higher level than the average citizen, but not to the level of a professional firefighter.
Right.
They teach disaster first aid, which is different than standard first aid. Disaster first aid is basically keep them alive. They teach damage search and rescue, light search and rescue. People know the difference between going into a building, for example, that is heavily damaged. They don't want you to do that. You're not a professional. You don't have the tools.
True.
But you can go in and recognize what a lightly damaged facility is. You can go in, extract the people quickly and safely because of the first aid training that you get in the course. You learn how to package them and transport them and treat life-threatening injuries or just general injuries. So the medical module of it, which is a full day or at least 8 hours, is
right.
very valuable in a disaster. It's not put a Band-Aid on something. It's how to immobilize fractures, stop bleeding, and how to get somebody breathing again. It's really a great program.
Yeah, the CERT personnel, are they issued any equipment to like have on their person or bring home to have? Or
well, it depends on the agency. In some cases, the agency sponsoring the training will issue a vest and a helmet or hard hat.
Mm-hmm.
Other ones give them more than that. They give them goggles and gloves and some first aid supplies. It depends on who's doing the training and how much funding they have to do that training. But you'll find that CERT people, once they get involved in it, they go out and get their own equipment. They go to...
Oh, okay, yeah.
They get, some of them are almost as well equipped as the fire department.
And wow.
It's a little scary sometimes.
Now, is the fire department, are they... now, you've dealt with the fire departments and everything. Or do they find this as a valuable asset, like especially if they get overwhelmed in a disaster, they're going to really look to CERT teams to help?
Absolutely. They're not just... there for disasters. The CERT people are very responsible. They learn techniques and how to do things. For example, the Hollywood Christmas Parade,
mm-hmm.
they provide security. They man the barriers that block the roads so that it's really a multifaceted type of training. It's not just disasters, but that's their primary purpose, of course. But they'll come out and they'll staff an information booth. They'll be first aid providers at the LA Marathon.
Oh, okay.
They put them out there. Not that they're going to do the same things as paramedics, but mm-hmm. but they know at what level they need to engage paramedics.
Yes.
They can take care of people who fainted or need hydration or sprain an ankle. They know what to do.
So. Right.
So, Bob, who do you find are the people that are most interested in this certification? Is it just your like everyday person, or is it people that are already maybe in the medical business or some other kind of disaster preparedness?
No, these are generally just good citizens that want to learn a little more to be able to volunteer their time. It's really interesting because everything you learn in the CERT program is applicable to your own family. So you can be able to take care of your family in a disaster because you know that EMS or paramedics, they're not going to be there right away.
Right.
They're going to be pretty busy. The more you know about it, you'll be able to take care of your family, particularly if you have an elderly person living with you or children. This is invaluable for this type of training.
Yeah, that's huge.
So, so we have all kinds of things. There are doctors who volunteer their time. I know one chiropractor who's a member of the CERT team, and everybody from A to Z.
Now, is there any age limits to get into the training or any special eligibility requirements or...
Generally, it's for an adult, but many departments, fire departments, many cities have a teen CERT program.
Oh.
So they can engage, I would say, 13 and above to learn some of these techniques. And it is very popular, and it's been very successful. So I would say from 13 to whatever age, you're still physically fit and able to do certain things. And then there's other parts of the CERT program that if you have a physical problem, you can become a support person within the CERT program. For example, maybe you can't sling a hose or use a fire extinguisher, but you can be sitting at a desk taking registration, writing down information.
Oh, yeah.
That's people have to do that, too. It's not all about the,
right.
the hands-on fun stuff. A lot of it takes some documentation, very important. So if you write well or use a computer or laptop, very important.
Then
very,
you can be a valuable member of the team.
Absolutely. That's why they call it a team.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And how, where can citizens go to get more information? Is there, local fire department or maybe a website or?
Well, the Los Angeles CERT community has a website. It's one of the best. It's called CERTLA-. Now, let me think about this. I want to give
the
correct one. If you go online and you look for CERT-LA, you'll probably find it.
It'll probably pop up,
and it's a very good site. It's maintained by somebody who's been doing it for a lot of years. Has all the information. It even has the syllabus for the course. So if you want to know what the course is before you decide to register, you can do that. By and large, fire departments are the focal point for the CERT programs.
Okay.
But whatever city you live in, if you just kind of check with the city officials and ask them about the CERT program, they'll steer you in the right direction.
How is it funded? Or do the individuals have to pay any kind of fees, or is this funded through the county? Or
well, that's a good question. It depends on the location. It depends on the sponsoring agency. In some cases, there's a registration fee because they do issue hard hats, goggles, gloves, and those things,
right.
Dust masks. Other ones, it's funded by some type of emergency fund. In general, the CERT program should be relatively inexpensive as far as getting into the program. What tools and things you use is up to you, and you can buy, like I said, you can go from Star Wars down to the very basics.
Wow.
So you don't need all that stuff.
No.
You know, you need, like I said, the basics, goggles, gloves, a hard hat, dust masks, maybe a few first aid supplies, triangular bandages. Space blankets.
Yes. That's a good segue into what is, because I know here in California, this is earthquake land. Absolutely. I mean, I know earthquakes happen all over the country, but it seems like California, because we have the San Andreas Fault, we have quite a lot of fault lines here, and we've had some pretty bad earthquakes in the past. And I think we can also put in the category of wildfires could be a disaster that we, you know, we have the potential of dealing with as well. What's some basic things that our everyday or ordinary families can do to help prepare?
Well, we have had a lot of wildfires, and it has caused massive evacuations, or at least the attempt to evacuate half a million people or more. Families need to be prepared to leave in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
And we have what we call a go kit. That is a bag, a box, a suitcase, whatever. And that go kit should contain very important papers, or at least copies of the very important papers, your insurance, your birth certificates, passports, financial records, whatever it is. It should contain some cash, generally in small bills, because if the power's out, you're not going to be able to use your credit card.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
And cash is king.
Yes.
So cash would be a good thing to have in there. If you have children, you need to have some things to keep them occupied, toys, video games, whatever you can do that. If they're elderly people, you need to make sure there's medications in there.
Yes.
And then, of course, comfort foods. Comfort foods are those things that will last a long time, but are easily obtainable from the supermarket. Peanut butter, canned goods of your favorite vegetables, tuna. Yes, they do have expiration dates. And what I personally do is when I have canned goods, I put the date that I put it into my go kit. After 6 months, I open the go kit. And I have set dates that I do this.
Oh, okay.
It was my wife's birthday and my birthday because we're almost 6 months apart.
Well, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah. And what I did is I would write with a marker on the can, you know, the date that I put it in there. And 6 months later, I would take that all out and go buy new stuff, put the date on, and take the expired stuff or the stuff that was soon to be expired, and I would take it to my local food bank.
Oh, good idea.
And I don't necessarily need the write-off or the tax deduction, but I would imagine if you talk to your financial people, there's some benefit there somewhere.
That's a great idea.
So water, there's many different containers and types of water. You don't need anything fancy. Some people want bottled water, the 16.9 fluid ounce bottled water. But after time, those plastic bottles deteriorate, and the next thing you open up your kit and you find out you have a bottle that has no water in it and everything else is soaked.
Wow, yeah.
So a sturdy container, something that'll last quite a while, would be good. There's emergency water supplies. They come in foil packs. Everything has an expiration date.
Yeah.
So you need to be aware that you need to rotate your stock.
Right.
So those things. You want to put Band-Aids and other valuable things that you may need if you're diabetic or if you're hypoglycemic. You need to have those medications in there. But you also have to rotate them faster than 6 months because a lot of them don't mm-hmm. don't have the shelf life.
On the water, do you suggest like having the water pills or water purification pills? Is that something that,
Absolutely, you can use that, and those water purification pills do work. They just take a little bit of time to work, but if you have some time, they'll work. There's a number of survival stores, and if you just put earthquake supplies or emergency supplies and you online, mm-hmm. and being online nowadays is such a convenient thing.
Yeah, everybody's on it almost every day, I think.
Exactly. So you go and you do your earthquake supplies or survival supplies, and you find a number of stores, and there might be one close by,
mm-hmm.
and they have all these things. They have water purification. They have Band-Aids and triangular bandages, which if anybody's ever dealt first aid, triangular bandages is like the go-to thing.
It can, oh, absolutely.
It can be used in so many different ways.
That's right.
But these survival stores, they have all the equipment that you'd want to put in your go bag.
Yeah.
And they're built and they have a long shelf life, which is what you want in your go bag. They're not expensive things. I mean, I've seen flashlights for $1.50. But if you don't have batteries, your flashlight's not going to work.
So, that's right.
Yeah. And don't store your batteries in the flashlight. They have a tendency to corrode that way.
Yeah.
I tape them to the outside of my flashlight.
That's a good idea. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Seems like one of the things here would be to at least have some kind of a kit together, even if it's not an mm-hmm. extensive kit, rather than just not having anything at all. And it doesn't seem like it would be that much of an effort to just, have a bag with some of the basic things like some water purification pills and a flashlight.
Yeah, it depends on the individual, but I'm not adverse to wearing the same sweatshirt for 2 or 3 days in a disaster situations. But
right.
I do like clean underwear, so I would have several pairs of that and maybe just a couple of sweatshirts.
Right.
And the other thing, too, is like everybody, I have children and I have grandchildren, and the little people tend to grow to be bigger people. So when you put that pair of Levi's in there for your son and daughter – 6 months later, it's not going to fit.
Yeah, that's right.
So you need to be conscious of time and space.
Right, and those go kits can be invaluable at the time where they really need it. So I think a lot of people should take a little bit of time out and really put one together.
Well, when I was younger and my kids were younger, I would give them things that they could put in their own personal go kit, and they thought, "Oh, gee, this is not a great present." But as they got older, and we had the Northridge earthquake, they appreciated the fact that I bought them a 3-day survival kit. It's like a fanny pack,
right?
That had food and water and some minor first aid stuff in it. Came in very handy at the time. I keep those things in my car. I keep them in an accessible area of my house, like a front closet that's right inside the door,
mm-hmm.
or in a shed behind my garage that has a combination lock so I don't have to look for keys. So you have to keep these things in a place you can get to. So three places: at work, in your car, and at home.
Right. Now, since we do have earthquakes here, maybe you can talk about a little bit about what people can do when they're at home or at work, when and if we do have a really good size earthquake, what are some of the steps they could take immediately and then after that, and what kind of things can they do to prepare for an earthquake and some of the do's and don'ts?
Well, the first thing is when you think you're experiencing an earthquake,
right?
You need to drop. Cover and hold. You need to get under something sturdy. You need to hang on to the leg of a table or whatever it is to keep things from hitting you in the head or in the back, whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the initial injuries in every earthquake, is something falls and hits somebody. The last thing you want to do is not run out of a building because you might run into several falling bricks.
Oh.
And in many earthquakes, that's what happens. People run out, and those are the people who get, unfortunately, injured or killed.
Oh, that's interesting.
So you want to drop, cover, and hold, and stay there until the shaking stops. And then you want to do what we call a self-evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
Am I hurt? Is there any blood anywhere? And then look around if you're at home with your family, and look around at work if you're with your colleagues, and make sure they're okay.
Right.
And then before you start moving at all, you need to take a look around. In the professional business, they call it a size up. But it's basically an evaluation of which way can I go, which way should I go. Is there broken glass over here? Is there electrical wires that are still charged?
Oh.
I need to avoid those.
Sure.
You don't want a mix of standing water and electrical. Because if you step in the water, it's all over. So you need to survey the situation around you and then pick what you would think or what you determine collectively is the best avenue to get out and go someplace.
Right.
Families should have a what we call a reunification area outside the home where everybody, no matter where they were, if they climb out this window or that door, they go to this relocation reunification area so
okay.
that everybody can meet up and you find out, you know, everybody's okay.
Right.
Don't forget your pets.
Oh.
Pets are family too.
And, yeah.
You need to make sure you have supplies for your pets as well as for yourself and your children and parents or whatever.
I remember when I was a kid and the 71 earthquake hit, my father came running into the room where my brother and I were and grabbed us and brought us into the door frame. Now, is that...
I was just thinking the door frame.
Yeah, what is it? Because I've heard two different stories about that.
Well, initially that was considered a place of strength in the home. Door frames were built with 4x4s and 4x6s and things. New homes are not constructed quite the same.
A
lot of aluminum things in there. It's, first of all, you got a door that may be swinging, so there's pinch points with the door slamming on you.
Second
of all, if the door frame is not really stable and it's leaning a little bit, you probably don't want to be there because the wall's going to visit you real soon.
Oh, wow.
The best thing is to get under something sturdy like a table. And I tell people I might look kind of big, but I can get real small when I have to.
Right.
And even a sturdy chair that you tilt over to cover your neck and spine is better than a doorway as far as I'm concerned.
And if there's no tables or chairs, say they're in a room and maybe there's a filing cabinet or they're in their bedroom and all there is a dresser and a bed, what do you suggest?
Well, if you can pull the mattress off and put it on top of you, that prevents things from coming down on top of you.
Right.
If you have a huge bed, a king-size bed, it's kind of hard to manipulate that mattress. So if you can get under the bed, that would be a pretty strong place.
Right.
Think about it, that one or two people in a bed, it's a lot of weight. So it actually would provide good protection if you could get under the bed. Unfortunately, many beds are very low or have platforms that are right on the floor. So you need to pick the best place and go to that place. Desks are good. Tables, dining room tables particularly. Coffee tables, not so much because they're usually pretty low to the ground.
Right.
You pick the best place in your house or in your office, and that should be your go-to place.
You would pretty much really emphasize the supplies, the little go bag. And you can use it for the earthquakes.
Sure, you use it for any disaster.
Any disaster.
There was a time my wife was going to San Diego, and there was a problem down by Camp Pendleton, and there's that very long stretch there where by the Marine Corps base. There's no services. It's just miles of Marine Corps base.
And that's it,
And she got stuck in a massive traffic situation that didn't move for hours.
Oh.
But she had the go kit, and she had water, and she had some Snickers or something in the bag that made it tolerable.
Wow.
Yeah. And with kids, you know, maybe you want to have some kind of that foil pack juice or something like that in the go bag, because the less stress you have to deal with, the better you're going to survive whatever the situation is. And not all disasters are earthquakes or fires or floods. There's little disasters too. So,
like being in a massive traffic jam that doesn't move and you have irritable kids in the back. That's a micro disaster, right?
It is. That's a mini disaster. You're going to have to deal with it. So if you have some kind of card games or board games that you have in your go bag, it's going to make life a little easier for you.
Absolutely.
And now with all the electronic things, probably ought to have some extra batteries too.
Right. That's all good advice. What are you doing now in terms of, you know, using all this skill? What are you doing currently?
Well, I'm more active teaching for the California Office of Emergency Services, the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, through the California Specialized Training Institute, which is located in San Luis Obispo.
Oh, wow.
CSTI is the acronym. Mm-hmm. And we each teach essential earthquake management courses all over the state. And we teach fire, police, public works, mayors, city clerks, anybody who wants to attend. How to manage an emergency operations center and support the people in the field doing the hard work.
Right.
Somebody has to be there to support the field workers, the fire, mm-hmm. the police, the public works, the nurses, the doctors.
Right.
They run out of things. And those people in the emergency operations centers, whether it's a city emergency operations center or a county or your own business emergency operations center, you need to know how to be able to support them. And there's actually, we do a week-long class that teaches people how to work in an emergency operations center environment. There's basically five elements to emergency operations centers, which is
right.
Management or command, depending on the agency you're with.
Uh-huh.
You have operations, which those are the hands-on people. We call them doers.
Right.
We have the planning and intelligence group, which are the planners. They gather information. They sift through it and make sure it's accurate.
Right.
And we have logistical people who are the getters.
Uh-huh.
And then the finance people who are the payers.
Oh, yeah.
So those five elements basically make up your emergency operations center. And when those people work together, it's a great operation, and the people in the field are the beneficiaries. That they won't be without hoses or water or medical supplies or food.
Right.
They need to take a break, so we would set up bases or camps for them to go and take a shower, get something to eat, find a place to sleep. So it's very complex, but it's a great course. We've been doing it for many years up at CSTI, and it's one of the most popular courses.
And how can people get more information from you or get in contact with you if they're an entity and they would like to consult with you or anything? Is there good contact?
Well, as far as CSTI, they can go to the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, or OES.
OES, okay.
.ca.gov.
.gov.
And look for CSTI or training.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll be diverted off to the training, and it'll show all the classes that are available. And there's many classes. It's not just earthquake emergency operations centers. There's classes for hazardous materials. There's classes for firefighters, for
right.
police. They do a great program throughout the state. So there's a lot of things available. And
very nice.
And then you contact the registrar and see whether it's sponsored, so there's no cost, except for the fact you may have to pay for a hotel and your own meals. But
oh, yeah.
And then there's the classes that you take for a fee. But it's all listed on the website, so that's a good thing. On the other side of the coin, consulting services, if you just look for Robert Lee or Emergency Management Consulting or Bob Lee, I'll pop up someplace on the internet.
And your contact stuff will be yep. along with that. Yeah,
yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Well, I think this has been a very enlightening episode. You gave us a lot of good, valuable information, and we really want to thank you. I think our listening audience is going to get a lot out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of really great information, a lot of information that I wasn't aware of myself, and I'll be looking up some of that myself too.
Well, I appreciate yeah. the opportunity. I like your website.
Thank you.
And I think the radio program is going to have some very valuable deliverables for the public.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to thank you again, Mr. Bob Lee, for stopping in and giving us information. We'll have a little bit of his information up on our website for people to, if they didn't catch some of this, we'll go ahead and have it on our website. So, again, thank you. And this is it for this episode. Stay tuned for other episodes. And thanks again for listening to the Informed Patient Radio Show.
You have been listening to the Informed Patient Radio Show with Eric and Roy. For more information, please visit us at informedpt.com. Tune in next time for more information regarding the healthcare system and how it affects all of us.